This is the Nature of Cities podcast. This is the Nature of Cities, a podcast about cities as ecosystems of people, nature, and infrastructure. We're devoted to the idea that better cities are built for and by people with livability, resilience, and sustainability as the principal drivers of design. I'm your host, David Maddox, founder and editor of thenatureofcities.com. Episode 1, Participation in Urban Open Space. The Nature of Cities was invited by the Smart City Expo in Barcelona to create a session. So in November 2014, we did just that, holding a session called The Nature of Cities, The Role of Green and Open Space in Cities That Are Resilient, Sustainable, and Livable. Five of us participated in the session. Landscape architect Eric Sanderson of the Wildlife Conservation Society in New York. PK Das, an architect activist from Mumbai and creator of Open Mumbai. Jane Engel, an urban planner and national curator of Cities for People in Montreal, and Tan Bornsboom, a senior director at Philips Design in the Netherlands. In our session, we talked about engaging communities for the beneficial expression of nature in cities and for the benefit of people who live in the cities. Why do it? How to do it? Afterwards, we gathered in the green room to continue the conversation.
Okay, let's go around the room and give a little thumbnail, a Twitter-length version of your message from today.
If cities are so smart, why are they so dumb about nature?
The whole challenge is about the integration of nature, people, and development.
For me, it's all about collaboration, bringing different pieces together, companies, organizations, people, to deliver the solution.
How can we better innovate and collaborate through networks to change our systems from large scale to small scale to transform cities?
We talked a lot today about the idea of finding a way to have citizens engaged in a way that they feel are not just consumers of the city, but are producers of the city. How are we going to get there in terms of finding a way to engage them for that purpose?
Well, I think we have to enlarge the group of people that can actually say meaningful things about what they want the city to be.
Eric Sanderson of the Wildlife Conservation Society.
And technology is part of that, but also is building movements and empowering people to actually be able to say what they want.
I think two things come to mind.
Jane Engel of Cities for People.
One is creating a culture of invitation, so inviting people to create in ways that we wouldn't anticipate through our usual tools and methods. But I also am reminded by something the mayor of Medellin said yesterday, and he imagines participation just having a huge set of tools so that people can engage in very different ways according to their own interests, according to their backgrounds, according to what's important to them.
Which would seem to suggest that we have to have a lot of tools in the toolbox, since different people will engage with different frequency, or some people might like some tools and not others, and so on.
Well, for me, planning and architecture has been very effective democratic tools of social change, social and environmental change.
PK Das of Das Architects in Mumbai.
And I think it's a fabulous way by which we can also engage people in transforming the physical conditions and bringing about change.
One specific tool is in Cities for People, we have a program called Transform Your City, where it's just a small grants program, $500 to $3,000, that individuals can apply for if they want to do something transformative in collaboration with their neighbors, for example, to change their neighborhood space or park or anything that they can think of, create a tool library or something like that. But we found seeding very small projects like that has been highly effective.
Next to bottoms-up approaches, as a business, I think we also have to change. I think, you know, we should not be afraid to work and talk with people.
Tan Bornsboom of Philips Design.
Not only talk to interview and do a focus group, what I'm talking about is that you truly make an effort to understand what they're all about. and also make a longer-term commitment in that effort and that understanding. And I think that is a change that also business has to make to that commitment in building up a long-term relationship with the users that we're serving.
To that end, you know, I think what's really important to remember is that the world's urbanizing really fast, and that creates many, many more people that we need to talk to. If you look at the world urbanization prospects, there'll be as many people living in cities in 2050 as there were people in the world in 2000. So that's a huge new thing, and that's going to transform everything about our cities. It means we need to rebuild our old cities to work better. We're going to be building new cities. There's going to be new customer bases for our businesses, and we have new ways to participate with those folks.
Yeah, but going about the idea of integration of business to people's concerns, I would say in the process of globalization and building these smart cities across the world, the numbers of people who are falling out of the benefits is staggering.
What types of benefits?
You know, the benefits of development, the goods of development is just not reaching. I mean, the exclusions are so huge by this process of development. So the real challenge is inclusion. And how do we really include these numbers of people who are falling out of the radar of development, the so-called development and growth, to make it much more inclusive and self-sustaining?
That's the digital divide that creates the have and the have-nots that we're working on. And I think we have to realize that. And on the other side, I think the other thing we have to do is work on trust. You know, I think there's a lot of talk about big data, and this is where companies can provide a good input, you know, because we may have abilities that from a bottoms-up approach cannot be generated. Yeah? So, but in order to deploy them in a proper way, we have to build the trust that we have this with the right intentions in mind and that we're doing decent things with that. So we all have to become good corporate citizens to really move innovation forward.
What we're trying to contribute through Cities for People is we're supporting a network of urban sustainability directors in the U.S. and Canada of city governments who are responding in very different ways but trying to learn from each other and which policy responses work well and which don't, and which responses work well with citizens, and how to engage citizens and businesses and all of the interests in this decision making, because it's such a critical issue right now for our cities.
Now, the other thing I think we have to learn is that we don't know the answers. Yeah. And I think we're all on a journey. Our immediate response is always, when we don't understand it, to maybe go back and say, let's keep it all the same. But we all know that a lot of changes are inevitable, and I think we should let them happen. But we should do it with our eyes open, and also don't, I believe in small steps, preferably bottoms up, but we also should be allowing ourselves to make a mistake. But that's why we shouldn't think too big and take small steps and let these mistakes happen, because that's the only way we're going to learn. And I think that is also, making the change process resilient. Resilience to me is experimenting and failing and stepping up and learning from there. That's, what nature always has done in evolution, and we should support this evolution.
No, I think one of the important things really is about learning, is to expand public space. As I keep saying, as the cities are growing, public space is shrinking by the day. And it's not just physical space that I'm talking about. I'm talking about democratic space, which is shrinking. And our effort would have to be, therefore, to expand public space in order to generate a much wider public dialogue on these subjects and make it much more inclusive in the process.
Expand a little bit on the distinction between public space, open space, and democratic space.
Well, as I put it in the conference, the open spaces does include the vast extent of the natural assets of our cities. And that's how you bring the natural assets onto public realm and to the public mind, in fact. And that's how public can relate with it and begin to think and realize that as part of their daily lives in the city. So the whole thing about public open space is probably the right way to put it. We're talking about public open space as being the basis of city planning.
Well, I was just going to say, when we think about resilience and change, and, it's important to learn, it's important to make mistakes, but we have to be careful as a species that we don't make a mistake of making the place uninhabitable for all of us. And we're in a time of such dynamic change, of urbanization and of economic growth and of globalization, that if we're not, not careful, we could change the climate in fundamental ways, change the way, water and carbon and so forth move, change the world for the fate of other species that we might depend on. So in this experimentation that we're all in, and the human race is in as a global species, we just need to also be wise in addition to being smart about how we build our cities.
I agree that we need to work towards the change, but what's the big change? of our mindsets, our obsession towards construction turnovers in our cities being the means for development or being the basis of development. We start assessing cities' developments based on the turnover of construction and real estate. I think we need to move away from that and begin to question how much it destroys natural environments and their regeneration.
Jane, you made a point today in the session that we don't demand enough of our cities. We should be more ambitious about the goals we set. What are some examples of some goals that would be more ambitious than we have now? And how would we create a consensus around what those ambitious goals should be?
We tend to accept the dominant paradigm of how our cities are built and not expect something different. So, for example, we expect that even though most of our cities, especially in Canada and the U.S. and Europe anyway, most of the public space in our cities are occupied by streets, and most of the streets are used for a completely private use and are paved over. And we tend to generally accept that. I think that's something that we should be challenging a whole lot more, that when we walk outside of our homes, we have this vast paved area that we could use in fundamentally different ways. It doesn't have to be paved over. It doesn't have to be used mostly for cars. It can be used for more parks, for more open spaces.
Cities are about consumption, and streets have always been places of consumption. And that is why you have such large paved areas and shops and everything lined up along these streets. And you made an important point. How do we need to turn around these streets to becoming sustainable environments that enriches the life and quality of environment in the cities?
And also the environment, other places too, of course, because if you make a certain choice about your transportation and its energy source, then you're also making implications for the rest of the world. In my own work, you know, I think that's why we have to start to value nature more, both the atmosphere that receives the waste that we create, as well as the natural resources, including the land that we build on. If we really do value nature, then we should value in a way that the economic system can really see. And that's one of those fundamental shifts that's radical, right? It's radical, but it's absolutely necessary to create this new world that we're moving into.
This point you brought up about how we treat land is fundamental and comes back to cultural values. In most of the ways that we do zoning, we're not considering at all the sacredness of land and how we need to be much more conscious about the implications of development decisions of individual sites, because we live with those decisions for a long time, for decades. A quote that I love by Paul Farmer, former director of American Planning Association, is that the site is to the city what the cell is to the body. So we can make a bad decision about one site, one important piece of land, and it has huge implications that are transmitted elsewhere in the city, just as if we have a bad cell in our body that can contaminate others.
Yeah, I think there's such huge legacies, just to build on Jane's point, that actually constrain our imagination about cities. Because it's so hard to think about how it could change, and yet we also know simultaneously it's dynamic. It's changing all the time. It doesn't change in whole-scale ways most of the time, right? So that's really one of the tricks, is to have the long view, but then to be able to apply it in the short view. And that's why we develop planning. I mean, that's why I work in historical ecology, because I'm trying to imagine this long view. That's where technology, I think, has a part to play. And just remind people that not only are we living with the legacies that were made by the people that came before us, we're leaving legacies now that will be what our kids and our grandkids receive.
It's been said that the majority of cities that will be existing here in 2050 are yet to be built. The infrastructure that we create for those new cities will be with us for decades, hundreds of years, and so we have to make the right decisions right now.
And I think to do that, also here, we have to just also start with the people. And I think what the other thing that we need to do is, yes, we can look backwards, and history can tell us a lot of things on what not to do and where to go. But the other thing we have to realize is that we're living in a world of very rapid change. And I think that is the challenge we have, is to really look at what that change is. You know, it's very, you know, I think you can have technology roadmaps and all kinds of things, but I think what's more important is to do something for people and citizens. You know, what is the citizen roadmap to 2030? How are they really changing? You know, what are the things that are changing and driving the changes in their lives? If you look at your own generation, I have a few sons. Yeah? Their perception of ownership of a car is something that is not part of their life. I grew up with it. I still don't understand why they don't want one. But those are things that are making a big impact. impact, and so are many things. Yeah. The way that they look at employment and the way that they look at earning money,
yeah.
You know, that has an impact. Do you want to own your house or not, or do you want to be fast, flexible?
I think that designing cities of the future, new cities of the future in particular, it's so important to do what PK was talking about, to design around first the open space infrastructure and the green infrastructure work, so that we're working as we build, as we develop over time, we're working with ecological cycles and so on. And also, I think that's in people's interests, right? Because we found over and over that people are happy to tolerate high levels of density if there are high quality open spaces around them. So it all has to do with the quality of life. It's not really the level of density that matters as much as the quality of the environment. I think that green infrastructure and open space planning are the basis for designing new cities.
And the design of these cities has to be holistic, as you said, and fully integrated, because it's not just about the open spaces, it's not just about density, but how those two things match together.
There is another important aspect in that, that it should be also for all kinds of people, all income levels of people, not exclusive people. Mm-hmm. These are not sanitized cities that are so beautifully laid out for some few types of people. They have to be poor people, they have to be middle class, have to be upper class, have to be people of all diversity. And I think that's another challenging aspect of the new cities that we have to plan for. Why I'm saying this is very important in present context. Take the example of the SEZs, the special economic zones, that have been built around the world. They've been so exclusive. They're barricaded cities. They're only meant for certain kind of people. That can't just survive. That cannot sustain.
We've been talking now for a while about the idea of participation. One of the reasons people talk only to like-minded people is that it's easier. You don't disagree very often. And in the case of streets, lots of people use those streets for commerce, for driving, for personal cars that they go outside of the city. So there's one faction that might want to have streets that are pedestrianized with cafes, but that flies in the face of another set of people who want to drive their car as fast as possible to their home in the suburbs. So the thing that we need to face is when we talk about the idea of participation, why hasn't it happened over the years? It's because different groups have a hard time coming to consensus about where to go next. How can we put people in the room that maybe don't agree and move towards some consensus around the direction we're going to go with cities? Is it a process question, having a better process of this participation, or is it like in every democratic process, there will be winners and losers?
Well, I have a bet with a friend in New York that about how cities will change, and his contention is that crisis is the only time that it changes. Hmm. And my contention is that there's a human capacity to be wiser than we have been heretofore, and he's winning. But I still hold up the chance that we can use the wealth and technology and intelligence that we have to actually make the wise decision about the future. He was betting on the crisis will force people to come together and make that collaboration happen. But in the absence of crisis, he doesn't see it's going to happen because people just follow their own parochial interest.
And you believe?
I believe that most people do follow their own parochial interests. But I believe there's also a capacity, which I see with my colleagues that I'm standing here with, to see beyond our own individual interests to the interests of the larger society and, in fact, for the planet as a whole.
I think that it's so important to be able to show alternative visions of the future. And I think this is where technology has a really important role to play, because we can say if we continue in our current course of development and growth in a similar way, this is what the city will look like in 50 years. This is what the city will look like. So then we show alternative futures.
I think technology has a big opportunity there. And I think we have to also innovate the engagement processes we have then with citizens. You know, because, you know, I know a lot of people who will never go to your square that you showed with the five fingers. And, you know, they're also part of that city, yes?
Yeah.
And how do we reach those? Because, you know, I think the people that are now making visible, they're paving the way for everybody else. But I think that's where technology comes in. And I think your website is a good example of how you can get citizens evolved. But I also feel that technology will do piece of the way, because I think the data revolution is just starting. Mm-hmm. Just like we, you know, I showed that, you know, we turn on the light with data. You suddenly see and understand what's really going on. I think that will, again, empower citizens, again, and make the public space for this debate and to engage a little bit larger. But first, I think we have to be very creative on how to then engage at all levels of society to mobilize them. And maybe you don't do that on a city scale. Maybe the city block is enough, but we have to be smart enough that we pull the city into it.
Cities around the world have similar problems, but yet cities are also different in many ways. They have different cultures, different geographies, and different histories of conflict. A lot of what we talk about here, technology-driven, participation-driven around, say, our ability to sync to the internet or have smartphones or access to data. Many of the cities that are currently developing in Africa and in South America and Asia, at this moment, don't have access to those kinds of technologies. How can we get out of the ivory tower in terms of these kind of participatory processes and make sure that all of the cities around the world get the benefits of this kind of forward-thinking, ambitious city building? How are we going to get there?
Well, many people don't have access to internets and blogs. So the question really is, how do we expand public dialogue as a tool, as a method of reaching and exchanging and discussing these new ideas? And I think that's the only way that we can build consensus. There would be ugly situations. There would be situations where some groups would be terribly dissatisfied. But so it be. But I think the whole process of democracy and public dialogue would sort of keep sustaining these bigger decisions in favor of larger interest. For example, we have to cut down on our dependency on private cars. We have to expand on public transport. We have to look at mobility in order to reduce the carbon footprint in our cities. I mean, these are issues that we have to popularize.
The motto, the mission of this conference is change the world. And in our conversation, we've talked a lot about the ways in which the amount of participation that we currently have in order to create better cities is lacking in various ways. But we all believe in the idea that participation, more sophisticated participation, more inclusive participation is critical to the creating the cities that we feel we need in the future. But we're going to need to change the world to get there. Do each of you think we can change the world in that way?
Well, I think more engagement would bring in a higher quality of debate. I mean, this is what I believe in. I mean, we cannot colonize ideas and, you know, term it as better quality discussion. The whole point is to open up these discussions to more and more people, and bigger participation would evolve higher quality ideas, undoubtedly.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, in my own work, I'm trying to find the opportunities to create more participation, but I have no way to make people participate. So that's the thing, is that it requires both. It requires the tools and the forums and the mechanisms, but then it does require people to stand up and say, well, I do care, and I will participate, and I will make an authentic answer.
Well, my suggestion is that, you know, people like you, me, all of us who possess some exclusive ideas or some very interesting, innovative ideas, if I may put it that way, we would have to join in, become a part of larger social movements in the city. We may choose our movements, but that's the way to popularize. That's the way to take it beyond our individual capacities and limits to wider participation. So you have to join social movements, is my mantra.
It's more a culture of experimentation, as Tan was talking about. It's a culture of invitation that we've been talking about. It's a culture of engagement, culture of supporting and enabling creativity that to me are important, and those cultures should underlie participation.
You know, being a Dutchman, you know, we have a government that takes care of a lot of things. So we basically get a little bit lazy. And then, of course, they keep publicly saying, you know, guys, you have to take care of yourself a lot more, definitely in the future. But I think the trick to participation to me is also do something where people immediately feel the value. And I think a lot of the subjects, yes, we have big issues, you know, big mounting issues. But, you know, it's very tough for me as a little citizen to say I can do something about it. And luckily we have a few people that go out on the street. But I think for us it is, indeed, what can we do on a scale that it makes sense? You know, how can I make my street a little bit more livable? And I think this is where we can be a start, right, you know, to learn people on a level of engagement. And maybe that's what we should accept, that we have to teach this new society another 10 or 15 years, or a whole generation has to learn to fend for itself in another way. And that is something that we have to to unlearn or change some things that we've done in the past.
I would say that there is this, there is a craving for change and for engagement and for different kinds of engagement that we're seeing, and especially in young people around the world, and all of the social movements, the Occupy Wall Street, the Arab Spring, the protests in Ukraine, the protests all over. We're seeing this this immense yearning for change and for a different kind of engagement. And so I think that's something to really harness the momentum of in the work that we do to create better cities.
We shall change the world.
I am Jane Engel. I live in Montreal.
I'm Tom Bosbaum. I live in Breda.
I'm PK Das. I live in Mumbai.
I'm Eric Sanderson, and I live in the Bronx.
And I'm your host, David Maddox of New York City, founder and editor of thenatureofcities.com. You've been listening to This is the Nature of Cities podcast, produced by The Nature of Cities, music by David Maddox. Copyright 2014, The Nature of Cities, all rights reserved. For more information about this or other Nature of Cities productions, visit thenatureofcities.com.